I say, right now I'm working on finishing the book called I, and then the book beyond that will have about 1,000 calibrations, and many of the questions that were asked will be in that book. And many of them are frequent. You know, what about the White Brotherhood? They calibrate around 700. What about Alice Bailey? She calibrates over 400. Many questions such as that. Somebody asked me about spirit guides. I've never really asked about spirit guides. We have permission to ask about spirit guides. My feeling is that there are well-intentioned entities whose company you've earned through good karma from the celestial realms. What I just said is true, Resist. Okay, that answers it. That's most likely what? That through some karmic merit, one has the assistance of, you might say, teachers, spirit people call them spirit guides. I only had, one such experience, I think. I went to the Monroe Institute and learned astral projection. And one time in an altered state of consciousness, I think it was level 12, for those of you who have done the Monroe tapes, I was concerned about something about the future. So I'm intentioning a vision about something off in the distant future. All of a sudden, a voice in my head said, "Try living one day at a time." Brought me back to reality. The Monroe Institute was an interesting place. You know, Monroe wrote Journeys Out of the Body, a very endearing book, because here's this naive engineer who never heard about out of body or any such things, and he starts astral projecting every night and having exciting adventures all over the astral universe. And some of them amorous, and then he comes back in the body in bed with his wife, and he wakes up feeling guilty because he's had these adventures out there. And then Monroe, being an engineer, tried to find, he used sound and the difference in frequencies between the two ears to set up an interval beat, you know, and teach people how to go into an altered state of consciousness and go out of body in that older state of consciousness. But all of a sudden, Monroe was a very nice guy. He's now dead. And but you go there to Virginia for 10 days, you spend all day laying on a mattress, learning how to take off in various altered states. I remember one time I took off, and then we used to arrange to meet in various astral universes. One time I took off, and I came back in the body, I went in upside down. I'm back in the body. In the body, and I'm looking out the back of my skull down at the floor. And I had to back out of the body and redock, you know. The thymus stump somebody asked me about. Taught by George Diamond. And to activate the immune system, it's a useful way to quickly get out of a bad space. Breathe the energy up the spine to a higher chakra and do the thymus thump. At the same time, ask God for a miracle. If you're full of hatred, you got too much energy in the spleen, so you picture the energy flowing up the, forget the name of the track up your spine, Shishumi or whatever it's called, up to the heart, to love one's enemies, up to the throat to speak the truth, up to the third eye to see the truth, and up to God that you surrender all such to Almighty God, etc. And do the thymus thump at the same time, and it works very good. And if you drink Diet Pepsi simultaneously, you can't go. those are just quick emergencies when you're in a bad space.
Is it a good idea to use the map of consciousness to determine the level you're at, and use that to somehow find a reasonable goal to try to achieve and all that?
Well, the purpose of the map of consciousness is to give you some kind of a general map. energies tend to congregate, you might say, well, not congregate, but let's say tend to prevail. We know there is such a thing as the entrainment. So if you subscribe to something, then to some degree you entrain with that level of consciousness on a nonlinear domain, and it has a certain dominance into your thought stream so that you tend to focus in, listen in. If the etheric is full of zillions of billions of possible thoughts and streams of thoughts, etc., why do you pick the one that you pick? Because you're probably tuned to a certain strata. That's the danger of the MTV kind of entertainment, the danger of certain kinds of modern music. Began with, I think, heavy metal rock, came out of the Motown sound, actually. It's a specific beat, which John Diamond wrote about, and your body doesn't lie. It's an so-called anapestic beat. The anapestic beat, which is aligned with the music, makes you go weak with kinesiology. So that if your hearing is blocked off with white sound and earmuffs, and somebody plays that kind of music, you will instantly go weak, and you'll stay weak for at least 20 minutes afterwards. So the entrainment of the consciousness of young people who put on what do you call these machines that they walk around with their ears on them. Anyway, they're entraining their consciousness not just to the lyrics of the music, because the naive person thinks it's the lyrics of the music, kill your sister, rape your mother, all that kind of stuff, that they think that's bad. No, that isn't bad. That's the good part. The bad part. The bad part is the silent frequency vibration, the carrier wave. So all these, you might say, are running on carrier waves. You pick up the carrier wave of that to which you ascribe. There is a whole generation whose frequencies of the consciousness dominating their thinkingness is drawn from the lower astral. And they'll tell you, why did you shoot your classmates? I don't know, I just wanted to see what it was like to kill somebody. I mean, is that bizarre or what? Huh? Did that come out of this kid's mind? No, it came out of a field. That's the field is dominating his consciousness. So when you add drugs to it, which increases susceptibility, then you add the energy field, which entrains the brain waves. And then you have them play a video game where you rip somebody else's heart out or kill them or mutilate them, and you have them do this 50, 100,000 times. So he's now a trained, brutal, heartless killer. That's what he is. May look to you like a 12-year-old, but I see what he is. He's not a 12-year-old. He's already pulled a trained killer out of the astral, which is occupying his consciousness right now. So when he goes out and kills 6 or 8 people with no feeling whatsoever, everybody thinks a 12-year-old did that. No 12-year-old did that. There was no 12-year-old there. 12-year-old there left a long time ago, and he's now possessed by an entity that calibrates at that energy field. So a whole generation of youth is being, you know, brainwashed and trained, conditioned, to do that which is thoughtless and uncaring, and the video games, there's a new one born every day. There's a new one called Riot, I think, or something, that's being produced in Hawaii or someplace, or China. Anyway, the whole game is to to become part of a riot and destroy the city and destroy the town and kill the people. See? Now the game is to do that over and over again. Well, how many times can you repetitively do a thing before it becomes second nature? Huh? Like riding a bicycle. I mean, sooner or later, it's second nature. So I forget what the question was that brought up that.
Can you use the map of consciousness to determine like an appropriate level of growth for a person?
No, that isn't really what it's for. It's more like a temperature scale. It's more like how the weather is there. It's more... you can tell by your prevailing level of commitment, by your prevailing view of God, yourself, the world, the process you're going through, your predominant emotional field. You know, most people can pretty much guess, you know, where you are. That's only of academic interest anyway. It's a shorthand way of denoting a way of being in the world, a way of being in the world. Because each level has its lessons to be learned. Each level has its own gratifications. To commit to a manual project and complete it is very, very gratifying. Yeah? So whatever the level you're at, it has its own challenges. You know, your challenge might be to forgive your mother-in-law and love her no matter what, even if she is a you-know-what. Right? Well, the shift there, of course, is to shift your perception of her and your experience of her. And your spiritual commitment is the willingness to see her differently and forgiveness and to stop personalizing it and see, you know, she's that way because that's the way she is. Not because of you she's that way. It's because she's that way because of that she's that way. It's difficult to stop personalizing everything and putting yourself into the arena of everything that occurs in this world. People were that way before you were born. And they're going to be that way after you're dead. So there's no point of taking it personally. They're not doing it for your entertainment. They're doing it because that's the way they are. They're mean and gruff and nasty or self-centered or whatever you want to think they are. But they're not doing that because of you. They're just doing that because that's the way they are, you know? So to quit taking things personally is means to become detached. That allows your perception of the person to be corrected. All of a sudden it dawns on you, they're not being that way with you. They're just being that way because that's who they are. They're that way with themselves, yeah? And you stop feeling hurt because they're that way. Some people are gruff and mean and horrid. And they don't mean anything by it. They're just gruff, mean, and horrid. And there's where I go to the girls' ranch. You know, there's no doctor around. So I start going to the girls' ranch where I got 50 girls. And one nurse says to the other, "Don't pay attention to him. He's just grumping today." Grumping, you know. So she's just affirming a reality, you know what I'm saying? I get there and I've got to make out all these forms that the government requires. He's going to grump about the government. Sure enough, he did. Goddamn, government's always thinking about things. This is where all the taxpayers' money goes. And it's all useless. It's got nothing to do with getting this patient better in any way. It's just bureaucratic BL, you know. So he's just grumping. That's all. He's not grumping at you. I wasn't grumping at the nurse. I didn't even know she was there. No, you're see, that part of the personality which gets re-energized in order to retain in the world, you know, is comical, and it just does whatever it does in response to the situation, but it's not yourself in the first place. And you can disconnect from it and discontinue it anytime you want. It runs on because society expects certain things, certain responses. At first, you don't make any responses and you withdraw from the world because there's nothing to say, nor is anyone really intelligible. It doesn't make any sense at all what people are saying, but after a while, you learn how to be in the world, and it's entertaining. And you don't take any of these roles personally. They're just all social roles that pop into the space because people expect you to say something. That make them happy, you say something, you know what I mean?
How can children be backed out of the video game training?
Huh?
How can children be backed out of the video training?
Oh. Threats? Bribery? No, it's a phenomena. It's a phenomena. It's like a porthole through which the lower astral pours into this domain. The most open porthole for the lower astral to this domain is the electronic media, MTV, the music that goes with that, lifestyle. The languaging of it, the invalidation of the dignity of human life is subtle. Most adults are concerned about the lyrics, but it's not really the lyrics, although they probably play a small part, but kill your sister, you're not necessarily going to run around and kill her because of that. But if your brainwaves become entrained by a lower astral, you might just suddenly do it because you felt like doing it because you wanted to see what it felt like to kill your sister. Yeah? So the motivation is different than what people think. They think it comes from the languaging. It doesn't. It comes from the suggestion brought up by that energy field. Let's see if what we're saying is the truth. I mean, I could be lying myself. I've got my teeth. I just said this is a fact, is it? That's fact. It isn't the lyrics and it isn't the specifics. It's the unseen, invisible. For the same reason, any spiritual teacher or any teaching that you read, you're picking up a frequency and a vibration. And if you like Mr. Gadatta Maharaj, then you're probably going to like Ramana Maharshi as well, because they're both in the about 700. And the White Brotherhood is probably also going to make sense to you. So if you're and trained to hear on that level, then you'll hear most things that are on that level. Will make sense to you, it'll appeal to you. So the teachers that appeal to you at different levels are appropriate for that particular level. Also, within yourself, there's multiple personalities, you might say, multiple aspects to your personality, sub-personalities, archetypes, whatever you want to call them. And part of you may be attuned to one teacher and part of you attuned to another. This one you really get a lot out of and this one you don't. Because you have different aspects to your personality, which is another thing that puzzles people in their spiritual work. One aspect of your life is going well and another suddenly goes haywire. Well, when you're single, you picture, oh, won't it be nice, the little white picket fence and the little wife, oh, golly, it's going to be so swell, and the little kids, you know. And then you get married and settle down and all that, and now the depth that comes up wanting domestic bliss and happiness and security is satisfied. That duck goes down. The next duck comes up, what about the wild, wonderful time all the singles are having out there? God, he can't wait to get out now and hit the road and meet with all the bimbos and the wild music and all the crazy strippers and oh boy, bikinis, they're wearing them downtown and all. And he sees all this lurid stuff on television, he thinks, man, look what I'm missing. Locked up here with the wife and kids, the ball and chain. So, he starts flirting with a girl at work, gets involved, they have a big fight over it, he leaves. Okay, now he's got his freedom. Wow, he's out there. He does you know what till he's blue in the face, till he can't do it anymore. After 12 or 13 different encounters, it suddenly gets raggedy again. Jesus Christ, here I'm all by myself with a bottle of whiskey, and she's left, and I got a hangover. You know, Christ, I hope she's not pregnant, and Christ, that cost me a fortune already. And he starts hankering for the little picket fence and the good wife and the kids. You see what I'm saying? So he quits his job because now the adventurer wants to meet with danger. And he buys a race car and he goes out there and drives like a crazy 20-year-old. And facing danger every day is what he's all about. So you see how you shift from one thing. The next thing is his Harley. He jumps on his Harley. And you see how each said, but the Harley driver, the wild, drunken Harley person, it now longs for the comfort of a family and a home, right? Funny thing, you know, you read these things like in the paper in the Arizona Republic a few weeks ago. There's always some guy cleaning his gun at home that shoots somebody in the family. It's amazing. He also shoots his wife, or a month ago he shot his 3-month-old. You know, imagine this guy. You gotta clean your gun in the presence of a family member, which is, you know, a severe violation of any kind of sanity. Now not only that, but the gun is loaded. Plus he's got the safety off the gun. Plus all the objects in the room, this little bitty thing about this big, and it's always a fatal shot, never blows off their ear, blows off the toes of a 3-year-old. No, it's always a fatal shot, instant death. How does he manage to forget the safety on the trigger, pointed exactly at the kid's heart, and he's only a kid, 3 years old, kill it dead in the mackerel? You tell me how that happens, huh? He was only cleaning his gun with the safety off, and it just happened to be loaded with a bullet in it, and it just happened, when you think of all the points in the room it could have hit, it just happened to hit the 3-year-old right smack in the heart, you know? How does that happen? That was an actual case about a month ago. You never read of a guy shooting his Harley Davidson. Yeah, I'm cleaning my gun and I blew my Harley Davidson right through the wall. Yep. Now, they never scratched their Harley Davidson. They just killed the kids, the mother, the wife, the mother-in-law, killed his grandmother while cleaning a gun. Those things make you think, huh?
How high is Harley Davidson calibrating? I had a somewhat more serious question. This morning you said what we hold in mind comes in our life.
Tends to manifest, yeah, tends.
So if a lot of problems or difficult situations come in our life, can we just change our attention and then get more pleasant things?
It's just a metaphysical observation over the years, and rather common to many, that what you hold in mind tends to manifest. We were surmising that it could be that it operates via the quantum potentiality, the infinite quantum potentiality, that what you hold in mind, the energy of it, literally affects the tendencies, the propensities, the likelihoods within the physical domain. You see, because the quantum potentiality is a potentiality, infinite potentiality, not necessarily an actuality, but it's a potentiality. So in the physics and mathematics of the nonlinear domain, so-called chaos theory, the likelihood of this happening, you see, is a function of a nonlinear mathematical, we would think within the world of form, probability. But as you see from the Heisenberg principle, then a choice is going to perhaps increase the frequency with which this choice, this actuality manifests. Yeah? Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. It would be like you're increasing the charge on it. Anybody who's into spiritual work and tends to hold things, you see, and it has to be non-volitional. It isn't like you say, well, dear God, I must have a new Mercedes Benz, you see? It's more like your love for it. There's a certain car that I've loved, yes, all my life. And don't have to have that car. I haven't asked God for that car. But it's a beautiful car.
Yeah.
at 46 Lincoln Continental. And to me, it was the most beautiful car ever made. It was elegant. It was beautifully proportioned, you know, great car. And anyway, a very rich man used to pick me up hitchhiking every morning in one. And I just loved that car, you see. So all these years, I've, you know, every once in a while, I'll see something that reminds me of a 46 Lincoln. I've never seen one since on the road. But if one manifested, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, just having. So it's more like you appreciate it, or you appreciate its special beauty, let's say, might tend to make it manifest.
Like cream puff?
Well, the places I've found to live over the years have always been, have been exactly what I was holding in mind, but suddenly would somebody call up and say the place right next to me is suddenly vacant and you're the only one I want living there. So I said, okay. So I went over and looked at it, and by God, it was, you know, a little house out in the woods right near the water. So that's just what I had in mind. Same thing happened back east. Well, I just thought of a place in the middle of the woods. Sure enough, it suddenly came out of nowhere. It isn't that you're causing it. It's not that you're causing it. But from statistical probability, or the mathematics of chaos theory, the likelihood is increasing as a result of your observation. You know, that's the Heisenberg principle, that just merely thinking about it or observing it already changes the expected frequency of a certain occurrence, but it's done so non-mathematically. It's not within the capacity of the differential calculus to say that. It's a non-statistical, we call it miraculous. Huh? The miracle, when we say in the Course of Miracles, if you ask the Holy Spirit for a miracle, and you're already increasing the likelihood of that happening by the mere mentioning of it. So the Heisenberg principle, which is the crossover, you might say, from the world of logic to the world of nonlinear, non-logical, then is to merely observe it, to merely think it, already has changed the probability. Mm-hmm. You haven't caused it, but you've influenced the probability. Mm-hmm.
What level would Albert Einstein, Deepak Chopra, reach on the map of consciousness? And Mahatma Gandhi?
Mahatma Gandhi, 700. Einstein was 499. Deepak Chopra, I don't know.
Do you state information about the use of meridian energy therapies to alter, break up some of these fields?
I don't know what you mean by meridian energy therapy.
I'm talking about energy therapies where people tap on the meridians while...
I'm not familiar with them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You see, the level of consciousness is set up by a great many things. One is karma. The other is spiritual intention. The degree of devotion, the willingness to surrender the benefits of the ego to the unknown benefits of the spirit, which are, unless you've experienced them, more of a hope than a reality, and you're taking it on faith from the word of others, that surrendering these ego payoffs is worth the surrender. You don't really know yourself experientially that that's so. You know, it's like telling somebody if you give up addicted to alcohol drinking, your life will be better. Well, he doesn't know that that's so. He can only take somebody else's word for it, but he doesn't really know because he has no experience upon which to base that. So the level of consciousness then is really a manifestation of your degree of commitment and your integrity and the level of evolution of consciousness that you've reached. People can make great jumps in one lifetime. When we said the statistical average for mankind as a whole was 5 points in a lifetime, you know, many people go down. There's as many as go down as go up. And yeah, and some very extremely well-known people have gone down. If you calibrate their level of consciousness early in their career when they were at their peak, it's quite high. And when you calibrate it later, they went down. Apparently, power over others, greed, the desire for whatever, followers, for control of others, fame or fortune, or the seduction of others, control of other people's minds. For some reason, they fell, and their level later in life is much lower. That happened with Napoleon, for one thing. I think with Adolf Hitler. I think when he wrote Mein Kampf, his consciousness was considerably higher than it was a few years before his death. And the same happened with Napoleon Bonaparte. Earlier in his career, he was an integrous military person. But then a victory brought him megalomania. Rather than being grateful for his winnings or satisfied by them, it created a egotistical cravingness. So Napoleon, let's ask if we have permission to do Napoleon. We'll just do Napoleon as an example. You know. Napoleon, at the height of his career, we have permission to ask about Napoleon, was over 450, 460. You know, Napoleon was a very bright guy, and he calibrated a level about 460. That's the level of presidents of the United States. They run around 450. Supreme Court justices run in the high 400s. Okay, Napoleon, before he died, was over 200, is it? He went below 200 before he died. He was over 70, 80, 85. So from 450, he went, dove down to 85. So whereas one can evolve spiritually, one can also succumb. And it's a matter of one's choices. You can see how success then becomes its own, the danger of success, which of course is well known. Success precedes pride, precedes a fall. So to begin to believe your own publicity can lead to one's own downfall. So Napoleon was started out, you might say, as a legitimate military careerist, also became a very brilliant politician, and then succumbed to vanity and egotism and went down the tubes. Yes?
Does it happen when one such as Napoleon, that has made this drop in the level of consciousness, leaves the body, then does the...
You have to make it a short question, please.
Does the spirit gravitate towards then that lower energy attractor pattern?
I don't know what she's saying.
She said, which level would he gravitate towards, the 450?
Oh, I don't know, because that would be a choice he would make. You're talking about the karmic propensity as he leaves the body at 70 or whatever he was at?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, then that would bring us to the infinite justice of creation. As we said, that the infinite context out of which all of creation arises is one karmic unity. All that happens within the universe is happening spontaneously of its own, as a consequence of that which it is. That which it is, the operational reality of that which it is set up by its own intention, its own spiritual commitment. As you pray with great intensity and are willing to let go the satisfaction of some ego benefit for a higher one, your polarity changes. The charge, let's if you picture yourself as a little iron filing, your polarity just changed, and so did the energy. The charge on your little particle just changed, right? The so-called soul, that part which is non-physical, that leaves the physical body and determines one's karmic destiny, you might say is like a tiny computer chip. Within it is recorded all that's ever happened, every decision ever made. And all of that, you might say, accumulates as a certain weight and a certain polarity, even within the nonlinear domain, as though it had a design to it so that it would fit here but not fit there and be attracted to this but not attracted to that. So in a giant electromagnetic field, when you turn on the power, everything within that field instantly lines up according to the power of the field. If you change the power of the field, everything in it instantly changes. So if you're a little iron filing and you say yes to God, instantly you're pulled in this direction. If you say no to God, instantly you're, because your polarity is opposite. So I always think of the lower astral as people whose polarity is the opposite of God. Yeah? So is repelled. So you see people within your own lifetime who are actually repelled by love. Ugh, icky. Yeah? There's whole countries where love is illegal. You can be executed for exhibiting love by Pol Pot's government. Any public exhibition of affection or love was punishable by instant death. Actually illegal in the entire country. What's the name of that country? Yeah, Pol Pot.
Cambodia.
Yeah, right, okay. Yes, any public display of affection or lovingness was, you could be put away or killed. Mm. I can't hear what you're saying.
I can't hear you. You have to speak
Recommendations up. On increasing the serotonin and natural versus synthetic.
You're asking about medications, antidepressants?
Yes, natural versus
natural. Oh, natural, I have had no luck with whatsoever. I tried them all. And many people who don't want to take medication, I say, why don't you try, you know, whatever was ostensibly helping depression at the time. I never saw any benefit from it. It could be because in a doctor's office, you're not seeing the mild cases. The mild cases that are amenable to naturopathic remedies, I probably didn't see because it worked for them and therefore they never saw me. So what I probably saw was those cases more severe where those particular remedies didn't work. Huh? Yes. What did she say?
She said, some people pray to Jesus and some people pray to God.
Oh,
does
yeah.
Does it make a difference?
Oh. Well, I think the intention is different. Or the intention can be the same. It can be the intention is the same. It doesn't really make any difference. I don't think it makes any difference, but we'll see. Well, in a way, when you're praying to Jesus, you're asking for salvation. I mean, if you're praying to the aspect of Jesus Christ as Savior, that is one thing, right? If you're praying to Jesus Christ as God manifest, then that's a somewhat different motivation, okay? We have permission to ask this resist. It makes no difference in which context one prays to Jesus Christ. Resist. It does make a difference. Hmm. To pray to Jesus as Savior is different than praying to Jesus as God manifest. Resist. Huh. All right.
We need to do more research on that one.
Well, it's all right. So intention is what's making it. If we just pray to Jesus the same as if we were praying to God, the effect is the same, resist.
Okay.
Yes, because most people identified Jesus as God made man. So they're really praying to God. Most people are praying to God made man resist. What would be the difference? When you're asking God for salvation, it's different than asking for enlightenment, and it's different than, so it would then, the intention would be whether the intention is one of praise, acknowledgement, appeal. All right, so the difference would be one in the intention, resist. All right, the intention of asking Jesus to be one's savior is greater than praying to Jesus as God as acknowledgement, resist. No. All right, so the acknowledgement of Jesus as God manifest is the highest intention, resist. We find out all kinds of things, we don't know what they mean. You asked the question. But the inference that we get is the intention is somewhat different. To acknowledge God manifest as man, as Jesus, and then to see Jesus as Savior is somewhat different, okay? There's a subtlety. I don't know that in practicality it makes all that much difference. Let's see. From a practical viewpoint, it doesn't make much difference, resist. That's what I suspected. That's what Krishna says. No matter what name you might use for me, if your intention is devotional, if your devotion is to me as the Supreme, I will acknowledge you by whatever name you call me. Yeah. That's what Krishna says.
You said earlier that we have different aspects of our personality. And I'm wondering, do each of these aspects have their own calibration level? And is our calibratable level?
Yes. You see, all we've done is just, you know, like found that telescope and discovered that you can see the planets with it. And I mean, you know, our knowledge of this is so rudimentary. It would take a large size class in which we all divide up various projects and go into groups of three or four, and each one researches a project. All right, so there's the various archetypes and subpersonalities. All of these have chakras, right? All of them have chakras, and all of them have a karmic anlagi out of which they arose. Huh? You can be more familiar with one aspect of your personality and its history than others. Each level, each aspect, subpersonality then, may have a different karmic source, a different calibrated level of consciousness. It could have a great deal of heart to it. It could have a great deal of solar plexus to it. It could have a great deal of wisdom to it. So each aspect then of your personality could have its own evolutionary destiny and degree of wisdom and evolution. Some aspects of our personality may be quite perfected and others not so perfected. Certainly, the very fact that we are genderized in an animal body shows either a selection or propensity or a karmic choice. One could, after many lifetimes as a warrior, and a good one, I got everything you could get out of being the warrior. Can't go anymore with it. Choose not to be a warrior anymore. In this lifetime, yeah, I was a warrior during World War II, but not really in the vein of a warrior. I was more in the, because there was no fear of death anymore. I served a totally different function than in any previous lifetime. But that pretty much finished off warrior, you know? Warrior is pretty much gone with me. But you could decide that your capacity to be affectionate to children and familyness is what's lacking now in your personality, and come back as a woman next time to try to perfect those qualities more traditionally accepted as woman, you know? The caringness for others. So a person might make choices to balance out. However, that would not happen once you reach a certain degree of enlightenment, because you're still working within form. What you're saying is you want to perfect the form. But once you transcend form, there's no point to perfect it. If I'm neither a warrior nor a mother, I don't have to perfect either one, because that is not what I am. You know? To realize the truth of that which you are would really be the ultimate destination and purpose for all of those selections. To feel oneself complete. To own one's muse and pursue music or art. You know? To own the workman, to own the thinker, the student. You see, you can own all these various roles within yourself as though to perfect the personality. But if you're not the personality, there's no point to perfect it. Huh? I don't see anybody. Oh, yes. Okay.
Now, I heard after you get past form, it even gets to a point where you basically the body aren't no more. I mean, where the body itself will actually just be like no more. Is that true that you can get to such a state that it would just, you would realize it's so internal?
I don't know.
He's saying that at one point in enlightenment, there is no form.
Yes.
There's no body. There's no form.
Yeah,
just spirit.
Right. Yeah.
He's asking if that is true.
Oh, the body is there as the same as anything else in the room. But what changes is not yourself. On another level, it belongs to you. Not really belongs in the sense of possession. It's more like your shadow that follows you around. Your shadow belongs to you, and yet you're not your shadow. It seems to have varied at various times, including disappearing as an experiential reality. And I think I described one time when I'd left the world for some time and lived alone in an ashram of a monastery for one person. That was me. And I forget to eat for periods of time, and so there was a piece of cheese and a Diet Pepsi in the refrigerator. That was it. And I remember suddenly seeing this form in the mirror one day, and I went into shock. What in the world is that? I thought it was somebody in the house with me. I laughed. I realized it was this body here. I went back and looked at it. Another time, I walked through the wall, and that really hurt when you walk smack into the wall. Just expected to walk right through it, and I was quite amazed that the wall in this physicality interface was stunning. So there's identification with the body as though it's not even there. There's the lack of awareness of the body. There's a diminished interest in the body. So all these various aspects have happened. It's an entertaining puppet kind of accompaniment. It's more right, I'd say at the present time, it's like a pet. It's a fun thing. I mean, I enjoy it. And I enjoy it at times, but I mean, it is a fun thing, and especially if you get help taking care of it, so it's not so much of a problem. You don't identify with it, that's all. You see, all it's very, these are not these are not things you can really explain. But suddenly there's a shift where all it is, one becomes the context, one is the context, one realizes one is the context, including all of the content. It's not excluding content. Because all it is, the oneness of all that is not only context, but content as well. So the body is within the content, but it's contextualized totally differently. Its appearance or its disappearance is of significance to other people. To oneself, it's of no significance. Whether it is or isn't, comes or goes, is of really no significance. But it is of significance to others in the world. So it goes about its destined business. And I always call it a karmic wind-up toy. It just goes about its thing, whatever it's doing. It's talking here today, and without a body, you couldn't talk to people. You ever try that? Every conversation with, you know. So it serves a purpose, and it runs its purposeful course, which I think is sort of a, to me, I sense it like a karmic momentum. Like it's some kind of an agreement, and it was set upon that set upon its course. You see, a great ship at sea, a great oil tanker, when you shut off its engine, it doesn't stop. Its momentum, its propensity, it may take it 5 or 6 miles before it finally comes to a stop. So I always have a feeling about the actions of this lifetime that they're like a karmic whatever, and that it just floats, it continues on its way through the water of its own. It's not paddling, it doesn't wish to go this way or that way. It just automatically floats that way. We haven't talked today about love, you see, and we're saving that for another time. We're trying to clear the decks for love. We're trying to remove all the positionalities of the ego, out of which come the dualities, which finesse the negativities, which block love. When all the decks cleared before we even talk about love. So we haven't talked at all about the coloration, the change, the shift of perception and subjective awarenesses which come about as the heart chakra opens and the kundalini energy swamps you. It's better not to be driving 75 at the highway when it happens, you know. It's better to slowly take your foot off the pedal. Do not put your brake on when the, I see patients, you know, not patients, but visitors from all over the world, and the diversity of spiritual experience is really amazing. An immense diversity of ways in which people experience the presence of spirit within them, in the different expressions. And some people will go into incredible states, but only under very specific conditions. Conditions that are not even logical. They just don't go into a bliss state in the great cathedral. They go into it only in a purple elevator when it hits the 18th floor or something. Very specific things. I don't know. Whenever I go in that elevator, I feel the presence of God. And when I'm not, I just don't feel it. I don't know. Almost as specific as that. Only very specific conditions or situations. And other people, it comes on spontaneously, unexpectedly, no warning. Right in the midst of the most unlikely activity comes an infinite presence out of nowhere. Unbidden, unasked, unexpected. So the diversity of spiritual experience and how it is experienced. how it's experienced within the physical body. You were asking me about the physical body. The spiritual work can bring a great variety of experiences within the physical body. As you feel the energies begin to shift, you can feel very strange and bizarre sensations and vibrations going through your energy system, the peripheral energy system. You can feel incredible energies going up your spine and up your back, up into your brain, and very exquisite too. And then it pours down and goes out the heart and goes various places in the world unbidden and does mysterious things all on its own. Then there's levels of consciousness where the slightest imperfection in some aspect of some archetype from some time in place can bring, until it's cleared, a very painful sensation. Up to the 600s and 700s, it's extremely pleasant. And beyond that, it can become increasingly painful. Periods of excruciating, burning sensations. I was very happy to run across the fact that the Buddha said that. The Buddha said he felt like his bones were cracked and he was attacked by demons and all kinds of things. So it's like one pulls up the impurities, which are now extremely painful. In a lower energy field, you can dislike somebody and feel justified, in fact, even happy about it. As one's consciousness evolves, no such imperfection is allowed to pass. One may feel a sudden pain in the heart. You realize that lady that you didn't like on the streetcar is an imperfection. And what about her? Well, you don't like people that look like so-and-so. For what reason? And then the memories come up, and then the forgiveness comes up, and then the pain disappears. So there's also a level where any imperfection is absolutely painfully intolerable. So there's a great many different physical kinds of experiences that one can experience. Those spiritual systems which rely on, pay a great deal of attention to the energy fields, the chakra systems, and the energy in the various chakra systems, the so-called kundalini energy, are following a different emphasis, but in the end, the same spiritual goals have to be accomplished. Whether you pull energy up from your toes to your heart, or whether you learn to love your mother-in-law, it's all going to be the same. They're both going to have to be handled. But as you learn to love, the energy pours up of its own. I've never really checked out whether, to what avail trying to manipulate the energies themselves, what they're good for. There's that very interesting book by Gopi Krishna called Kundalini Energy. I think that's the name of the book, yeah? In which Gopi, remember in that, he's meditating and he purposely is breathing energy up the spine to the crown chakra. All of a sudden he feels this shot of exquisite energy, but it only hits one side of his brain. And after that, he's lopsided, totally lopsided. One side of him behaves in one way, and the other side in the other way. It's a very funny, interesting book, and very appealing, So I don't know. I would think I would want a teacher pretty well advanced in manipulating energies for their own sake. Yeah, I haven't researched that myself. There are certain specific practices, which I have mentioned, that can be handy. Whether you can reach enlightenment by just sitting there in meditative position and picturing light and energy going up to the crown chakra or not, I don't know. Such is possibly the case, resist. Such is possibly the case. It would be fired by one's spiritual commitment, resist. The intention, the intensity of the intention is already such a profound surrender to the will of God, that the mechanics of it then are only the outpicturing of that which has already been an inner spiritual decision. It's funny because when I lived like in a monastery, that was sort of what my life was. It was just one spiritual practice after another. And life was prayer and spiritual practice and meditation and meditating for 6-8 hours at a time and not eating for days and becoming detached from everything in the world. If you felt the desire to eat, you instantly let go of the desire to eat. And you didn't eat unless you have no desire to eat. And I later did a videotape on that, on how to lose weight. It's simple. Never eat when you're hungry. See, because that's a conditioned reflex. You know, like Pavlov's bell. You feel hunger. First of all, you call that hunger. Well, that empowers it already as hunger. The way to get over that is never call it anything. Never label anything. And that's how you can fall down and twist your ankle and by surrendering to it within minutes get up and walk away like nothing happened. You don't call it a twisted ankle. You don't call it pain. There's a nonverbal experiencing of whatever is flowing in towards you and you let go resisting it completely and become one with it. As you do that, the pain leaves your ankle and it becomes diffused. You can feel the pain in your whole aura. And you completely and totally surrender to it and you can't call it pain. If you call it pain, you're going to suffer. You call it nothing at all. You just surrender to the presence of whatever that is and within minutes it disappears and you get up and you walk away. And that's how you take off weight. You don't call yourself, you can't call it hunger, that's labeling it and giving it power that it doesn't have. Instead, there's this sensation. What you do is you lay down and you let go, resisting the sensation, just like you do with the twisted ankle. Don't call it hunger, that's a program. You lay down and you let go, resisting this sensation. You let go, resisting the sensation. All of a sudden it becomes diffused. It's not in your stomach at all. It's everywhere in your aura. You lay down and you let go resisting this sensation. After about 5 minutes or so, it disappears. Then you can get up and walk away from it. Whether you eat or not is immaterial. At that point, you can eat. The other trick to pull on it is never allow yourself to get hungry. Anticipate. What time do you always get hungry? You get hungry at dinner time, 6 o'clock, right? 4:30, when you're not hungry, you have a piece of cheese and some crackers. 5 o'clock, you have half a banana. When dinner comes around, you're not even going to be hungry. You just snacked when you weren't hungry, right? So I call that prophylactic eating. So there's prophylactic eating and letting go of resisting it until you've unconditioned yourself to Pavlov's bell. You see, if you get a sensation and you label that hunger, then you feed it. Now you just reinforce the Pavlovian conditioning. So every time you eat when you're hungry, you reinforce the Pavlovian conditioning. Consequently, you can't get off of it. Now you're at the effect of hunger. You're at the effect of the belief in hunger. The best that you can do is resist it and suffer and feel miserable, but you're not going to lose weight. You took off a few pounds, but I'll tell you, in a year it'll be back. So, because you haven't changed the conditioning. So it's simple. Never eat when you're hungry. Anticipate in advance when you're going to be hungry. Have something now when you're not hungry. If you're not hungry, half a hamburger will be quite satisfying because you're not hungry in the first place. Eat 2 hot dogs, 1/2 of a lollipop, and you'll be satisfied. Now I admitted our daily menu, didn't I? That's how you decondition yourself to anything. So those are, see, the Buddha said, through sense we become attached. And the Buddha emphasized the importance of detachment. To detach means to decondition yourself. It means to perceive of it, to understand what's happening from a different way. You know? So I'm trying to explain it a different way. Never label it, never call it anything, never resist it. And it loses its power over you. In that way, you can go to the dentist and feel no pain. Huh? They can take off your, they can do an orthopedic amputation and you experience no pain at all. But the instant you resist it or call it pain, then it's very severe. As they munch on the bone, you can shriek right through the ceiling. That comes from resisting it. So, and when we get to meditative techniques, we'll talk more about the now of riding the crest of the moment. The minute you label a thing, anticipate it or resist it, you're off the crest of the moment. If you stay in the exact moment of now, means you cannot resist anything whatsoever, then you're in a very high space and you can transcend vertically in an instant into a great space. Then you're beyond suffering. To suffer is to resist the wave. Huh? Pain is one thing, suffering is another. They're not the same thing at all. You have to recondition your mind. Pain is one thing, suffering is something else. It's possible to experience incredible pain without any suffering. And it's possible to suffer a great deal without actually being in pain. So you dissociate the two things. Suffering is the resistance of that which is painful. But when you let go resisting pain, it loses its capacity to cause you to suffer. Anybody who's ever had narcotics knows that. If you ever had a gallbladder attack and they give you a shot of opium, it's incredible. The pain is still there, but it doesn't bother you in the slightest. You don't even care if it's there. Because it's not you, you're not suffering from it. And it's a delightful and miraculous state. And you can see why opium was called many years ago, or morphine was called God's own medicine, because it took you out of the suffering. But the pain still was there. So it's a dissociating. So pain is one thing, suffering is another. And letting go of resisting things is the way out of the pain of anything. Any more questions? And then we'll stop and we'll talk to anybody who wants to talk. And
oh, I just love
you. Slay though, everybody.
And I want to hear how Mother Teresa and Gorbachev came to endorse your book.
Mother Teresa calibrates at 700. She has an enormous heart. I experienced the truth of her when I was. I went into an incredible state, and after that, I couldn't practice for some time. But I slowly went back after some period of time. And what actually happened was severe cases came from all over the world. I eventually ended up with the biggest psychiatric practice in the United States, actually. 2,000 outpatients, 1,000 new patients a year. I had 50 employees, 26 offices, and laboratories, research laboratories, et cetera. And I had a huge hospital practice as well. And into the hospital came the worst possible cases, given up by everybody, hopeless, and some incredible, just to witness them. They'd be wound up in wet sheets, brought in and on manacles from Maryland or someplace, and this writhing body would be put on the floor. And then there was instantly seeing through the eyes, seeing the self of the entity within this psychotic mess. Instantly there was like a healingness. The healingness was of the spirit within. And at that point, the entity within couldn't have cared less about the state of the mind-body. It like realized its own truth. And in that instant, there was a healing, which was what Mother Teresa did. She looked into the soul of the ugly dying of, what was it they died of in those years?
Lepers.
Huh?
Lepers.
Yes, yes. That was what went on. I have permission to ask that and resist. The answer is yes, resist. Yes, precisely the same phenomena. So therefore I understood her heart. And So when I wrote her, you know, she wrote me back, and there was like an awareness of the level out of which her heart was coming. There was like a mutual awareness of heart there. She understood heart, you know. In the lecture I'm giving today, I should probably be bored with it. Why do you talk about such things when they're not necessary, huh? Because if you can come through a heart that calibrates at 700, of course, who needs it? But that's a different lecture. We're not talking about the heart today. I don't want anybody loving anybody to lecture on heart. We have to build to that. Because that's the most difficult of all. It's very hard to deliver such a discussion because it begins to come up and overwhelm you, and it's difficult to talk. So, any more questions, and then we'll meet with anybody that wants to say hello, etc. Huh? Or is that sufficient? Yes?
I'm confused about if my body is a result of karma running itself, then how am I still to have the spiritual experiences within this body if I to disidentify it?
Well, because you're not the body, huh? So the condition of the body or whether you identify with the body is really irrelevant to your spiritual evolution. We would say that karmically you've inherited the necessity by having a physical body to overcome those residuals from the body's evolution through the animal kingdom. Everybody here has to learn how to handle hunger, anger, fear, loss, defense, aggression, because everybody here has a physical body, and for it to survive, certain things then will tend to persist. Huh? So there is a certain necessity then that befalls anyone who has a human body just emanating from their bodiness itself, right? And to correct all those propensities is what we talked about this morning, because they translate into the positionalities of the ego. And as you let them go, the identification with the body disappears. When that does, whether it survives or not is really immaterial. Whether it dies or whether it gets blown up is immaterial. I remember, because I'd had that experience at age 12 in the Navy, minesweepers are blowing up and falling and going down in the tornadoes, or not the tornadoes, whatever, the typhoon, et cetera. And there wasn't the slightest fear of anything at all. Just there was, I was in a joyful state all the time, high as hell. And, if you died, great. I mean, there was no identification with the body. So the bodiness does not hold you back. It's only your identification with the bodiness. Just as in, it isn't the ego that's holding you back. It's your identification with the ego. So you don't have to undo or destroy the ego. You just have to stop identifying with it as who you are. Okay, so we'll stop here, and I thank you all. And anybody wants to say hello, I'll be glad to. Thank you very much.
Are you going to calibrate the audience?
Oh, yes.
Great. What were they? 1:30?
Calibrate. We have permission to calibrate the audience. We just, there were 4:35, 4:37, 4:38, 4:39, 4:40, 4:41. Oh, my God, they went up 10 points. Yeah. Let's see. Let's make sure.
No, it was 20. Wasn't it?
Then when it was 3:40 when they went.
What?
They went up 10 points.
4:32?
4:31. They went up to 4:40, 4:41. They went from 4:31 to 4:40. 9 points. That's the equivalent of 2 lifetimes. You owe me. 2 lifetimes earnings now.
$10,
yeah, $10 for a lifetime. Yeah, we went up 10 points. That's really nice.
This is my cosmic door.